From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for August 28th, 2020. It's also the last day of the meteorological summer. Summer's over, kids. The league-leading Milwaukee Bucks continue their playoff run Saturday in the Orlando bubble, and the Brew Crew is home this weekend with the Pirates. KFC is pulling its slogan, "It's finger-licking good," in response to the pandemic. Corporate HQ thinks the slogan is inappropriate at this time. Come on now, it's not like they're asking you to lick someone else's finger.
Oh, boy.
In other fast food news, Dunkin' Donuts is closing 800 of its stores due to COVID-19. No donuts. This coronavirus stuff is starting to get serious. And our obligatory Florida story, 750 million genetically engineered mosquitoes are to be released into the Florida Keys. The idea is reduce the mosquito population by adding 750 million Frankenstein mosquitoes. What could possibly go wrong? Haven't these scientists ever seen a Frankenstein movie? And finally, Japan is a bicycle riding country with a very low crime rate except for bicycle theft. While a psychologist has come up with an ingenious plan to cut down on the bike thievery, he manufactures fake bird poop. That's right. You buy it, you place it on the seat of your bike. Even the most hardened criminals don't want to sit on that. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kilb, Dave Sandstrom, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. And a good week it was. The NASDAQ up 3.4% this week, closing today at 11,696. The S&P 500 up 3.3%, closing seven consecutive days as of Friday's close, seven consecutive positive days, closing at 3,3508. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 2.6% this week, 723 points positive this week, closing at 28,653. For the year, the NASDAQ now up 31.1% when you factor in the dividends. The S&P 500 now up 10%, 1.4% of that coming from dividends, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up positive 2%, 1.6% of that coming from dividends. So as you look down the line here, now all the indexes positive for the year finally, not just counting on dividends anymore for those few that were having challenges. And I think one of the major disparities that we continue to talk about is just how significant of a gap there has been between the NASDAQ and much of the broader markets. And in particular, when you look at the tech stocks that have been a big piece overall, whether you're looking at FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, or whether you're looking at FAM, the Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, however you measure it, there's really a short number of stocks that have driven a lot of the excess return. And so, one of the things that we've been talking about quite a bit on the podcast is the gap between growth and value. And the other conversation we've had quite a bit is this idea that markets have become a bit stretched in terms of valuations. And so I think it's not fair to split those or divorce those two conversations. And Brian, I know that one of the things that we talked about this week in our Monday morning meeting was this idea that, if you look from peak to peak or from when the market peaked back in February to the recovery of that peak in August, the Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Google component of the S&P 500 was up, roughly 29%, we'll call it on average. That's 22.5% of the S&P 500. The rest of the S&P 500 down almost 8.5%. And so some of the conversation here is, that's what's driven that performance gap. But that's also, I think fair to say what's driven a lot of the stretch in valuations. It isn't because the whole market has rallied exceptionally well. I think a good piece of that is because of how well those FANG or FAM or whatever, however you classify them, how well those stocks have rallied.
Kyle, in a more of a general sense, because I don't want to get caught up in the five companies or six companies or, dates and whatnot. But the disparity you talk about in returns is just astounding, you know. But I think if you went back to earlier in the year and you looked at the stocks that aren't the top five or six, things look pretty about like you'd expect them, with returns down maybe 8 or 9%. You know, and you start to then marry what's going on in the underlying economy. You know, people talking about maybe being back to 90% of where we should be with the economy. That's kind of reflected in the markets. If you take out or extract those five or six huge companies and those incredibly high returns, I think then you go back to the value piece and you say, well, if price to earnings ratios are in the mid to lower 20s, including those companies, and you take those companies out where PEs are, you know, in the 40s, you're left with P's roughly in the 19 or 20 range, which compared to the historical norm of 15 or 16, gives you a much fairer perspective on where the broader markets are, which then you can start to talk a little bit about where the opportunities might be, because even in that group, there's some cheaper stocks and more expensive stocks. But certainly, I think down the road, there will be something to pick from. But more importantly today, it isn't that the whole market is overvalued. It's that it's being skewed significantly by those handful of big stocks.
Well, and I think we need to identify the fact that there are reasons why some stocks should be worth a higher PE than other stocks. That if your growth prospects are more favorable, it might be worth paying a little bit more for that stock. And so, you know, as you say, part of the conversation is, you know, that the whole market isn't as expensive as what the market on average is. But the other part of that conversation is that there's some deals out there, whether that's in stocks that are cheap, but maybe unfairly cheap, or whether that's in stocks that are that look expensive relative to the average, but maybe there's a reason why we're a little more willing to pay for them.
You know, Kyle, I think go ahead, David.
Kyle, I was just going to say that if you look back, you know, just over time, the S&P as a whole has kind of gravitated more towards some of the higher P, typically, you know, tech stocks over the years. You go back to 2008, about 16% of the S&P was the energy sector, whereas today we're down to about 2.5%. You know, back in as recent as 2013, Exxon, largest company in the world, which incidentally just got removed from the Dow this week. So, you know, you got a much larger component of the and makeup of that S&P are those tech stocks that you would expect to pay a little bit more for. And I think so that kind of goes hand in hand with elevated PEs maybe being a little more acceptable and maybe not such an alarm that we might have, you know, looked at it a few years ago.
You know, Kyle, I want to make a point about some of the bigger companies and especially the growthier side. I had this discussion with a client this week. You know, if you look at Apple, pick a company like Apple and you say, my gosh, these guys have grown forever at an incredible rate. But to the point today, I mean, if you're in excess of $1 trillion in capitalization, growing at the same rate isn't quite as easy as it was when you were a $1 billion company a whole bunch of years ago. You know, you think about how many more iPhones or iPads or whatever Apple has to sell to justify the earnings growth that you're paying for that stock right now. And it makes it pretty challenging. So I do think, you know, there's good companies with good reasons to be overpriced, but people need to also be a little bit careful when they're buying stocks just because they've done so well in the past, because it does get incrementally harder.
You know, I think that's such an important point. And, you know, maybe just we could really get into the weeds on individual stocks. Yeah. We could really get into the weeds on, you know, kind of the business models that are out there. But I think, you know, a major difference today versus 20, 30 years ago in a lot of these biggest companies is that much of what they do is dependent upon laying the groundwork for future sales. Once you've laid that groundwork, an incremental sale doesn't cost all that much more. And so, yeah, it costs a little bit of money to make another iPhone and sell it, but a lot of Apple's revenue, for example, is coming from the ecosystem. It's coming from the App Store. And so there are some differences, I think. And you know, as Dave, you mentioned, I think that's one of the reasons why higher multiples are supported. But, you know, I think, you know, Brian, as you rightfully point out, let's be a little careful about how excited we get over some of these stocks that have already seen so much love. You know, I mentioned we could go in 20 different directions on, you know, just that stock. But, you know, I think the other piece is that, Dave, you mentioned Exxon. Apple also in the news this week, a couple of different directions we can go there. Maybe just starting with Apple and Tesla as well that are undergoing stock splits right now. And I think we get questions every once in a while about what that means for investors. We get questions about, why would a company want to do that? Don't they get some value from being priced as much as they are? And so just as a reminder, Apple in the middle of a 4-for-1 stock split, that means that for every one share you have, you're going to get four. You look at Tesla undergoing a 5-for-1 stock split. For every one share you have, you're going to get five. And granted, we're always proponents of buying a fund, buying an exchange-traded fund or a mutual fund that focuses on balance, that gives you broad diversification so that you're not tied to any one of those individual stocks. But that said, for a variety of reasons over the years, we know that our investors have accumulated positions like Apple, like Tesla, where they care about what's going on in these businesses. And so, Dave, maybe just a moment on kind of what it means when a stock splits, and then, just another moment then on, why should investors care? How does it help us down the road?
Kyle, typically a split on a stock is more for a liquidity move than anything, and certainly is not does not increase or decrease the value of the company. Just more shares outstanding at a lower price per share, simple math. I think some of the arguments for and against are, again, the liquidity portion. If it's cheaper per share, you might get more of the average investor to have access, to buy in a share of stock. A typical example, Warren Buffett, always against volatility, never wanted to split a share. And so the Berkshire Hathaway right now trading at, north of $300,000 a share. So not access to the average investor, right? So you do see some increased volatility there. But I really believe that, like I said, it doesn't change the value of the company, doesn't change the, value of your shares, or you don't have more or less when it's over. So really a non-factor as it relates to the value of the company or the shares.
I think there's some historical precedents, some historical research that suggests that companies that are priced highly, not relative to anything, just that their stock price is high, after they undergo a stock split, they can attract smaller investors that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford the shares. I mean, historically, that's been a positive thing for those stocks. I think there's a little bit of a difference right now in the prevalence of things like index funds that are major holders of many of these stocks, where most people who invest already have broad exposure to these companies. You're not going to see a drastic, new inflow of investors who couldn't invest before because the stock was trading at $800 or $1,000 a share. Yeah, maybe that's the case for Berkshire at $300,000+ a share. If they ever split, you might see some new people come in because affording one share is buying a small house. But, I think the vast majority of these companies, people weren't turned off by them because they traded at $1,000 a share and now they're going to trade at $200. It's that they already had enough inside their portfolio.
So we should probably take a minute, Kyle, to say happy birthday to Warren Buffett, who turns 90 on Sunday, right?
Big day for Warren, absolutely.
He has reminded us that what led to his success was at an early age, him kind of grasping the idea of compound interest, and that if you made a little bit of money over a long period of time, the miracle of compound interest is really what drove his success. And I suppose if you were smart and as successful as him, and if you live to be 90, I guess that's how you get, worth $82 billion or something now? So a lot to learn from that guy.
He has certainly had time on his side there and certainly made some good choices along the way in terms of finding opportunities. So happy birthday, Warren. I think the other piece, Dave, that you mentioned earlier was, ExxonMobil's removal from the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Add Raytheon and Pfizer, and it's the second pretty significant change to the Dow this year. You look back at the history of the Dow, those changes happen maybe every other year where we see some kind of switch. And in place of Exxon, Raytheon, Pfizer, we're adding Salesforce, Amgen, and Honeywell to the index. And so, I think one of the outstanding questions, of course, is why go through the effort of removing what are pretty relevant businesses still, Exxon, Raytheon, and Pfizer, in favor of businesses that are, you know, maybe just as relevant, but might represent a little bit of a different part of the economy. And then I think the other conversation here that we need to have is what's the relevance of the Dow with respect to investors broadly, with respect to the economy? Because, you know, I think you look at the variety of different ways that you can measure what's going on here in the U.S. or in the world more broadly. And the Dow for a long time had been the thing, maybe not anymore, but had been the thing that people quoted. And really, I think we've transitioned away from looking strictly at an industrial average like the Dow and looking more towards, you know, broader measures such as the S&P or the Russell indexes, which I think are more reflective of what's going on. But, you know, first and foremost, what's going on with these changes, Dave?
You know, I think it's just, you know, you got to remember the Dow industrial average is picked by, you know, picked by people as an attempt to try to replicate a fair view of what the overall economy is made of. And you got 30 stocks to do that. So when we see, you know, things transitional, you know, transitional times in the economy like we're seeing now, or oil and energy are becoming less of it, we're moving more to technology. It only makes sense to adjust the index occasionally to try to get a better representation of really what the economy looks like. I think it's interesting to see a company like Honeywell return, you know, old, very long historic company. And then it's kind of refreshing to also see a company like Salesforce come onto the scene. So it, you know, represents some of the new and more innovative things that are going on in the economy. But I think, as you were kind of alluding to, it is only 30 companies in there. And I think in the short term, the Dow has proven to be, you know, maybe sometimes be a little disjointed from the rest of the markets. All over longer term, you know, timeframes, you see the S&P and the Dow, I think, are pretty representative of what's going on out there.
You know, maybe just to point out that unique to the Dow Jones Industrial Average, yeah, maybe there's a few others out there that do this, but unique to the Dow is that it is a price-weighted index. And what that means is that the higher your price is, if you're one of the Dow components, the larger the weighting you have in the Dow. And so understand the conversation we just had about Apple and that 4-for-1 stock split. Apple has been a major component of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That stock split now means that they are a far less significant component. And so if the makers of the Dow want the average to continue to reflect what's going on in the world, what's going on in the U.S. at least, you know, the addition of something like Salesforce, which kind of is in a similar vein to what Apple does, in that it's technology relevant, but also, you know, I think a critical business infrastructure piece. You know, it only made sense that something like that would be added to capture a little bit of that flair that's being lost with Apple's kind of reduction in the average. And so, you know, I think that in and of itself is fairly unique of the Dow. And then you look at the fact, as you said, that it's 30 stocks. I think, you know, when I'm looking at what goes on within the U.S. markets, and not that what I have to say about this is the end all be all by any means, but I think for the most part, when we're talking about markets broadly, I prefer to look at broader measures, whether that's something as simple as the S&P 500, which I think pretty fairly captures, you know, what investors should be looking at, or even more broadly, looking at total market indexes. And there's plenty of those out there that look beyond just the largest businesses, because I think it's, you know, fair, especially here in the U.S., to try to gauge what's happening with smaller businesses. They're such a big piece of who we are as a country that, you know, to only look at the largest businesses, I think you miss a piece of what's going on. You know, I think a major piece of news this week that has gotten missed in a lot of everything else that was going on was Fed Chair Jerome Powell's speech on Thursday. Brian, some on the surface look like fairly minor changes, but could have some pretty serious, you know, knock-on effects to kind of the way that we view the inflation mandate, or the way that the Fed views the inflation mandate, you know, maybe placing some greater emphasis on the jobs market than they ever have before.
You know, Kyle, I think it certainly practically in the short term probably doesn't mean a lot to people, but I do think it gives them a greater leash down the road to allow inflation to pick up a little bit more than it might have, you know, without getting into a technical discussion of the Phillips curve and how this all relates. I do think what it does is it allows the Fed to do what it can to help unemployment, you know, in these times, racially sensitive times, where some people are so much more disadvantaged. It gives them a few bullets in their gun to try and help steer things in a little bit different direction, even as they are, you know, supposed to be independent politically. It does give them a little bit of a different mandate in terms of how they might manage the interest rate situation down the road, which could, if done properly, you know, kind of help the whole unemployment thing, which I think might make some sense.
You know, what I think is interesting about this is we have, you know, going back 5 years now when we heard the president of the Chicago Fed talk at Marquette, known about this concept of symmetrical inflation targets, meaning that if for a long time inflation runs below that 2% target, you can let inflation get a little bit above that 2% target. And the fact that you had Jay Powell come out yesterday and say that we're going to rely more on the long-term averages than we have before, than we are simply on saying we're not going to let it get to past 2%. I don't think it was an overnight decision. I think it's a conversation that the Fed's been having for a very long time. It's just that in this environment, it's even more relevant than it's been, you know, the past 10 years, certainly. And you know, looking beyond that, I don't think we've been in an environment where, you know, inflation kept in check for as long as it has been has really been a concern. And so, you know, there are reasons to think that inflation could move higher. You talk about, you know, Brian, a concern that we've shared on the program a number of times, the amount of stimulus spending that has taken place and the amount that's likely to take place still. You talk about the fact that as interest rates remain low for extended periods of time, it potentially spurs inflation down the road. But I think the reality is that we still have a lot of hurdles before inflation is the one we have to worry about. Again, I think reasons to think it may emerge down the road, but you know, the Fed has not said we aren't looking at it anymore. The only thing we care about is jobs. What they've said is we're going to allow that target to be a little more symmetrical than it has in the past. You know, I think obviously from interest rates comes a conversation about the dollar. And when you look at what had been a period of strength for the dollar, certainly since the financial crisis, that, you know, I think by many people's accounts had allowed the dollar to get a little bit stronger than maybe it should have. And what that means is that, you know, when you look at investing around the world, for example, or investing outside the U.S., those investments are priced in local currencies. They're priced in the euro or the yen or the renminbi. And then when U.S. investors bring those returns back into the dollar, dollar strength meant that those returns were worth a little less here than they would have been for investors, you know, in those local currencies. And so what I have, you know, been most interested in watching is that since the mid-March high for the dollar, since the kind of the strongest point for the dollar that we've seen, that the broad basket of currencies relative to the dollar have strengthened about 9.5%, or said in other words, the dollar's declined about 9.5% since that mid-March high. And so, you know, I think, Dave, one of the things that you and I have been talking about, and I know it's a conversation we've had, is at some point in time with U.S. stocks looking expensive, at some point in time with the dollar remaining fairly elevated, non-U.S. stocks have to become attractive. And I have to think that, you know, seeing a 9.5% tailwind to returns for non-U.S. stocks since March is one more reason why maybe more people start to look outside the U.S. for a portion of their portfolio.
Yeah, Kyle, and I think it's also important to, you know, kind of look at the reasons why in some of the areas of what would cause the change. And a lot of it has to do with, I think, what you're bringing up is some of the currency strengthening in other economies, especially over in Europe, due to probably some growth prospects. Maybe they're handling the pandemic results a little bit better than we are in some people's minds. And so that I think that some of the early forecasts for quicker growth is appearing in some of those marketplaces. And of course, it's monetary policy is another big issue with the dollar strength and the amount of stimulus and easing that we're providing here, obviously weakening the dollar a little bit. But you're absolutely right. I think that investors have been, a lot of investors, been looking for an opportunity to get overseas or look for some other opportunities perhaps outside the U.S. market. And this could be one of those good opportunities coming. I think especially when you look at the emerging world, you know, one of their biggest headwinds is a strong dollar. I mean, lots of dollar-denominated debt in the emerging world. You know, they spent many years borrowing money to build up infrastructure to supply the world with commodities and raw materials for the growth we've seen over the last 10 to 20 years. And boy, I tell you, when the dollar gets really strong, that really impedes their ability to service that debt. So this could be a significant tailwind for those economies to take some of that pressure off. So I definitely agree with you. I think there's some opportunities that potentially on the horizon here if this trend continues.
You know, Kyle, I think if you take this issue and a couple of the others we've talked and you try and kind of bring them together, you might say, well, if you look at FactSet earnings for the next couple of years, right? The end of last year, we ended up at about $163 on the S&P 500, expected now to go down to roughly $133 at the end of 2022, back up to $167, or essentially right where you ended 2 years ago, right? Before COVID started. So you look at the broad market, as we were talking earlier, and the broad market, you know, a bit higher since COVID started, and yet with expectations for earnings to be about the same, you know, what is now a year and a half down the road. I think where the opportunity comes is to look at how kind of some of the underlying pieces have been changing and how, you know, the different parts of the market start to break up. And maybe you have opportunities overseas for a bunch of different reasons, including the weakening of the dollar. And maybe you have opportunities in some of the broader indexes on the cheaper side of the stocks or some of the parts of those broad markets that aren't reflecting of the overpriced handful of stocks, or maybe it's the small caps that start to kind of emerge as an opportunity. But I think if you start to look beyond COVID and beyond the problems of the last few months and how they play out over the next year or two, the important thing is to kind of look ahead and say, hey, where might these opportunities lie and how do we take advantage of them?
You know, maybe just a final thought on kind of the dollar is, you know, we use terms like dollar strength and dollar weakness. Keep in mind that that's not completely reflective necessarily of where we are as a country or kind of, you know, whether or not the U.S. is strong, that there are, you know, advantages to having a strong dollar, but there are also some pretty significant drawbacks to that. And in particular, as you look at trade, dollar strength and dollar weakness don't necessarily translate to strong economic growth one way or the other. And so, you know, I think one thing to say, yeah, we want the country to be strong, another to say that we want the dollar to be strong, because that does pose some hurdles for foreign consumers consuming U.S. goods. And so, you know, it's an issue that can be politicized. I think, you know, we try to do a pretty good job of saying here's the pros and cons of dollar strength and dollar weakness. But just know that, again, there's going to be some drawbacks to that dollar strength, just the same way there's some drawbacks when the dollar starts to weaken as well. You know, Joel, a lot of economic news this week, as usual, or as we've seen recently, some data on housing that continues to point to some positive signs.
Yeah, Kyle, I think, you know, that data joined a bunch of other data that show that we're recovering from the setbacks that we had when the pandemic first started. But there also are suggestions that it's slowing, that the National Association of Realtors this week, looking at pending home sales, they were talking about having a V-shaped curve. And we've talked on the podcast before about that. Well, the upward end of that V is starting to look more like a jagged line of a lightning bolt, or that whoever's drawing it has hiccups or something. It's still going up, but it's not going quite as fast. So we had that was actually a really good number. So the realtors do an index that show pending sales based on contracts that people make for buying houses. They don't necessarily always go through, but it's up a lot. And they've actually revised their forecasts to say now that they're going to sell 5.4 million houses this year, which would be a 1.1 increase from 2019. And they think it's even going to go higher in 2021. So that's good if you're selling a house. The other side of it, though, is that they've complained for some time, the realtors have, that there's not enough housing inventory. So they're actually saying that it's getting scarce. We also had numbers on new home sales, which is a much smaller part of the market. That's something that the Commerce Department follows. And that showed also that sales of new homes are going up, that they're, you know, as high as they were in 2006, which is saying a lot. But as far as inventories are concerned, the inventories are back as low as they've been since 2004. So if something's got to give there, usually one of the things that gives is price. So the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index continued to go up in June. That's usually a couple of months behind. So we're seeing that housing prices are still outpacing inflation overall. So there are some questions there about how sustainable the housing recovery is going to be.
And some data on consumer sentiment and kind of more broadly how the consumers feel, and, you know, mixed data there for sure.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we always point out that consumer spending accounts for 2/3 of the gross domestic product. We had revisions on the GDP on Thursday, and that actually showed that consumer spending declined 34.1% in the second quarter. That's a lot. Especially when you're counting on 2/3 of that driving your economy. So today, though, we had fresher numbers just from the month of July, and that showed that consumer spending was going up. So the second quarter, you know, ended in June, and now we're starting to see that go up. But again, that rise is slowing. And that consumer spending isn't going up as fast as we've seen prior to that. The consumer sentiment, consumer confidence numbers, those are kind of looking ahead, and they're saying to consumers, hey, how do you feel? And usually that's a gauge for, you know, whether people are going to be spending more or not. And the consumer confidence number from the Conference Board was as low as it's been since 2014. So people are kind of iffy with the COVID, with, you know, maybe there's some uncertainty with the stoppage, or at least the suspension of some of the supplementary income that the government was giving out. There's a consumer sentiment number that came out from University of Michigan today that also it referred to sort of, it said remained trendless in the same depressed range that it's traveled in for 5 months. So we're not seeing a whole lot of increased optimism there. Kind of those are also fickle things. So we'll have to keep a watch on consumer sentiment, consumer confidence. There was a poll that came out from the Associated Press that showed that more Americans are saving their money and not spending it. They're a little tight-fisted, which is, you know, good in the long run. I mean, that's that paradox of saving. We like people not to be too loose with their money, but to help the economy, we really want to see them spend more.
You know, I think so often we look at the economic data and it tells us a lot about where we've been, but very little about where we're headed. And, you know, I think as we rightfully point out, a lot of that spending data, a lot of the consumer sentiment information that comes out, and especially, you know, surveys about what savings look like and how consumers feel about the months and years ahead, I think can be very informative about the direction of the economy. And, you know, the knock on from that is that, you know, that informs the direction of stocks, not completely, but certainly that's part of the underlying ability to grow earnings. And so, It's why every week we look at the economic data that's out there, but I think more importantly, why we pay special attention to a lot of that consumer-facing information, the housing data, the sentiment information, because you know that's ultimately what you know helps to inform where we're headed.
Right, and again, that gives us short-term looks, and we're, as investors, we're in, all in this for the long-term, referring back to Warren Buffett, who apparently Brian thinks listens to our podcast. I saw somewhere that 90% of that $82 billion of his wealth, that came since he was 65. So that's going for the long
term. So you're saying there's a chance for me then?
For everyone, Brian.
Well, for everyone. All right. Well.
Again, happy birthday, Warren. Hope you're listening, as you always do. It was wonderful having a chance to share with all of you this afternoon. Hopefully, our audience will continue to grow, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.